So good morning, everybody, and thanks for the invitation to come and talk about proximal sensing. So we've been up in the sky looking down, and now we're going to come down onto the ground. And I put this slide up to begin with because it's been an interesting journey using proximal methods for the last 15 years or so. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the work that I've done, but largely I've just drawn what I think are quite interesting studies from the literature to give people an overview and to give some direction on where things might be going. One of the interesting things when you come from the sky onto the ground is that you bump into interesting friends along the way. And so in California, I've bumped into a few rattlesnakes. In Cambodia, I got chased by bulls. And in Trinidad, I confronted a caiman, and that was quite an interesting experience. So I got started with proximal sensing at the Salinity Lab in Riverside in California. And Jim Rhodes really pioneered a lot of the methodology looking at salinity assessment. And Dennis and Scott Lesh, who worked with him, really taught me and educated me in the use of EMI. And this is one of the rigs that we had in Southern California that we used to take out to the farms. So what is proximal sensing? Well, really it's about obtaining signals that are either non-invasive or minimally invasive. So if we can avoid digging holes, then that's really great. One of the things that I've looked at recently is this review from 2011. If you're interested in proximal sensing, I'd really recommend it. I think it's really thorough, it covers a lot of ground, and it's well worth taking a look at. So this is the sort of structure of what I'm going to talk about. I thought I'd start with the statics. A lot of proximal sensing was about mapping and be able to look at properties, structures and features. And then we'll move on to some of the dynamics, where I think these systems are really good as observing systems. And then how it's being applied to experimentation, because I think that's an important step to go from observing to actually bringing proximal sensing into experimentation. And then in the new technologies bit, I want to be thinking about whether you and what you carry in your pocket is going to be the new proximal sensing system. So one of the good things about proximal sensors is this idea of scale. And we've seen these sort of spacing and in time and distance diagrams. And proximal sensors have an advantage, especially the geophysical ones, that you can cross these scales up towards remote sensing. So going from the sort of point measurements and being able to upscale, and they fill a gap. And useful in these diagrams is the ability to see the things that we can't yet observe. And some of the challenges are being able to push into those areas, especially to increase the space and be able to increase the time resolution on the sensing. This is some work by Sebastian Rudolph, who was at Jülich, working with Harry and some of the others there. And he was interested in drought stress in arable production and whether they could detect drought stress. So they were using rapid eye imagery for remote sensing, and that was proving very useful with the leaf area index and the ability to be able to detect where there's drought stress. But the only problem with the remote sensing is that you tend to detect the stress when something's died, so it's a little bit late at that stage. So they were wondering whether they could use proximal sensing using the geophysics, in this case electromagnetic induction, to get some idea of the locations in the area and the fields that they were working with to determine where the vulnerable zones were. And on this side, you've got the sort of traditional pathology map, and then the EMI maps that were taken. And I think one of the nice things that Sebastian was doing was that rather than trying to use the signal and then relate it to soil properties and then try and relate the soil properties to the drought stress, he just went straight for, let's look at the signal, let's look at the heterogeneity in the signal and see if we can relate this to zones that are on the ground. And I think just being able to take that signal and relate it to the thing that you're interested in is quite a useful approach and sidesteps some of the issues that you have with calibration, because you don't always need to calibrate to a certain soil property. So some of the things that he identified was that the proximal sensing was very good for being able to detect wet zones, dry zones, and trying to understand the processes in this system. This was a braided river system in the subsurface. It looked very uniform on the top, but once you got into the subsurface, you've got lots of sands and gravels, and being able to identify those with the proximal techniques, which go deeper into the ground, and the remote sensing was very powerful. So it identified these paleochannels and also allowed them to understand the hydrological regime and lateral flows in the water. So another piece of work that I come across is when you start to combine measurements, and there's power in being able to combine measurements. This was a piece of work published in Plus One, where they'd taken the ECA map and at the same time they were measuring pH and the near infrared. And with this combination of measurements and some sampling that was targeted on the ground, they could start to correlate the relationship between the signals and the species of earthworms. And I thought this is quite a nice application, where rather than looking at physical or chemical properties, you're starting to look at biology. And so they were able to use the information, put it through some modelling, to be able to create spatial maps of earthworm distributions. And I thought that was quite a nice idea of where you can take it, because it's very difficult to try to obtain spatial biology. It's not an easy thing at the field scale. So it's quite a nice way to think about how we upscale biology. This is some work that I did in California, where it's starting to go from static into the dynamics, trying to understand dynamic systems, again, which can be difficult to observe. So with soil moisture sensing, we're very limited in the number of sensors usually that we can put out for looking at things like soil moisture processes. So this was a watershed that I was working in, several hectares. This is the outflow from the watershed at this point. And we were looking at the wetting up. We wanted to know when stream generation occurred and how it was related to soil moisture patterns. So this is the rainfall during the time, and these numbers relate to the electrical conductivity maps that you can see collected with the electromagnetic induction. And at this point, where there was a step change, there was quite a substantial storm, and stream flow was generated. But what we can see in these maps is the patterns as the soil wets up and you get the building up of the moisture in the soil. And then suddenly at this point where there's the major storm, you can see a real wetting at the top end of the catchment, and that's the point at which stream generation occurred. And that remained then throughout the autumn and into the winter, with stream generation occurring. And you can see the breaks when you look at the distribution of the signal. So that's starting to help us with dynamic processes. This was another study that I looked at from China, where it's a more traditional, I guess, kind of study using using proximal sensing, which is to look at how leaching can be used effectively to combat salinity. So they'd started off with a saline intrusion in their field sites, and they were able to target the leaching, and by doing so, using proximal sensing methods, they were able to see how effective that was at removing the salinity from the system. So there's very definite applications here, practical applications for these sorts of methods and techniques in terms of moving to the dynamics. So back to some work from Sebastian that he conducted in Thailand. And this work was trying to understand how proximal methods could be used and linked into experimentation. And they had a large experiment looking at intercropping and agricultural practices. And what Sebastian did was to go around and collect proximal data on all of the experimental sites. Now, when you look at this zone, what's normal with experimental sites is that they choose a field that's homogeneous. So, and just by looking at it, you can't really tell whether it's homogeneous. A traditional soil mapping might indicate, well, it looks pretty homogeneous and it's all classed as the same soil type. But what the proximal sensors are able to do are to pick up differences that are very subtle and can't be picked up through the naked eye. So they were able to take their electrical conductivity measurements, and they were interested in plant height, and they could take it through a sequence of modelling and simulation and then look at how effective it was in terms of explaining the variability in the height of the maize crop with the response trials. And so by linking it in, what they found was that the estimation of the treatment effects was more precise when they started to incorporate that data with the electrical conductivity information in it. So there's definite benefits in being able to have that information, and it's explaining differences in the soil. We might not know exactly what they are, but we can start to identify where some of that variation is coming from. Now, work that I'm involved with at the moment is trying to understand soil change. We're working at the national scale. This is monitoring from Wales from the last 30 years. And this is used to inform policy to understand how soils are changing across the country. So whether it's carbon or pH, nitrogen, this information feeds into policy. So for example, the pH over the last 30 years or so has increased by about between half and one unit on a national scale. And this is in response to policy intervention that has reduced sulfur emissions across the UK and continental Europe, so that pHs are now rebounding. So there's a question of how proximal sensing and how proximal methods can help, because it's pretty expensive when we go out and collect this sort of information. We're very limited in what we can do with the design, and so spatially we get less information. So about 5 years ago I got quite interested in the idea of using citizen science. So to what extent could we use citizen science? Can we use the phone in your pocket and yourself to start to collect information? So this was an awareness raising exercise that we conducted, the creation of the MySoil app, which covers the UK and Europe. And it gives out some basic information. When you select a point on the screen, it'll tell you about your organic matter, your pH, and which people find quite useful. We're finding that gardeners particularly like this information. But it also allows you to crowdsource information. So it's like a kind of social network that you can put in information about your soils, what your soil properties are, you can do some basic measurements. And really, we were interested to see whether there was any interest, because we thought, maybe you'll get, you know, a few hundred people using this. But so far, we've had more than 50,000 downloads and more than 4,000 records uploaded. Now, the information that we get at this stage is not really useful scientifically for mapping soil properties. But it is quite useful for both the engagement, but also understanding places where we might want to go and look at with our monitoring, where in space our detection might not be so good. So the next steps forward are whether we can use the visible and the infrared spectra to be able to get at soil properties and be able to improve what we can do over just using a phone. And so certain soil properties you can detect in the visible, not so great, but improves as you go into the infrared and especially into the mid-infrared. And there's quite a lot of work going on at the moment in various places being able to use infrared techniques. And industry has taken this on. There was a nice study recently where the EU, with its LUCAS survey across Europe, it had 20,000 points covering the 23 countries, and they looked at the lab ability of relating properties to reflectant spectra, especially with the organic carbon content. And when you look at the entire data set, it's not bad. It's not bad at all at being able to detect carbon. So with the lab method, it's reasonably good. This is taken on to industry applications. Soil Cares is a company in Holland, and what they've decided to do is to try and take ground-based data. They take XRF data of the soils, they take the infrared spectra, and then based on that data, plus local measurements made by somebody on the ground with their sensor, they use algorithms to try to predict a range of properties in the soil. Has a range of pros and cons. Some people I talk to say it's great, and some people say it's got a few snags. But that direction of travel is an interesting direction of travel. As is some work by Matt Aitkenhead at James Hutton in Scotland. So he's gone similar approach, but just using your phone. He just takes a picture of the soil. He colour corrects it. So by using colour correction, you can get a much better quality image and standardise across the methods. He also takes the data from soil monitoring and links the two together in order to be able to predict. And when you look at his estimation of things like loss and ignition, it's not bad considering he's just taken a photo of the soil. And he figures that he can predict reasonably a range of different properties in the soils. So just a few thoughts to finish, that the use of proximal sensing gives you a way to observe the system that you wouldn't otherwise have. It picks up heterogeneities that you can't see, and it has real good potential for being linked into experimental platforms to explain some of the variability that we see. At the moment, it's not good enough for change detection in looking at soils and how they change. But over time, maybe that's the trajectory forward, that not only will we have photographs, but we'll have other sensors on a phone, and each of you will become our next proximal sensor.